Have you noticed that instead of listicles or photo galleries or like all the other clicky stuff, now the new thing is ranking? Every Star Wars ship ranked.
Yeah.
The internet is somehow getting lazier.
We haven't even reached its mass yet. It's going to get to a point where it's just, look at this picture.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Back with me again is my regular co-host from Portland, Oregon, Richard Wally.
Hello, hello, Mr. Cassidy Robinson from the Los Angeles area.
You know, I kind of like recording in the morning only because my voice is a few octaves lower than normal because I'm still a little like froggy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gives me this kind of like sexy vocal fry.
Ooh, baby. Let's talk about films. Get down on it.
You went to a horror convention back in our old stomping grounds in Utah.
I wouldn't call it that. It was a ground that we walked on lightly at times when we had to see concerts or movies or such.
Right. Adjacent to our stomping grounds. What happened there? Because I know that at one point you ended up doing a podcast with a prominent horror writer.
Yeah, I did that.
And I keep checking that podcast to see if it's gone up, but I'm assuming he's probably backlogged it.
He's backlogged a bunch of them. He recorded a bunch of people at that event.
Mm-hmm.
It was dumb luck. Anything that good happens to me in my life is through dumb luck.
Well,
I was at a panel with him, and he was going to do a new author newbie recording. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, do you want to go up? I was like, yes. Yes, I do.
But how did he know you? Like, I mean, how did, like, did he just, like, literally pull you out of the crowd randomly? Or was it, had you had, like, talked to him at a booth or something?
Oh, Brian Keene, that's the author we're talking about, he's a pretty high level horror writer. He's a really awesome dude. He's one of my favorite horror authors. And so when I was standing outside of one of the event halls, he was standing there and I said, I really like Dead Hollow and I just finished it. It's a book that he just wrote, which we can talk about. Actually, I guess I have some news from that. He's adapting it with a fellow in New Zealand through Weta, I believe. And so if you're a fan of his, then or you're a fan of New Zealand horror, that might mean something to you. But yeah, so I talked to him a couple of times and he was like, hey, do you want to come up? That was it. I had talked to him. See what? Okay. So there was a couple things about, so this was the World Horror Convention for this year, 2016. It was held in Provo. Now, if you know about the area, that seems like a bad choice. And it kind of was, if you're talking about foot traffic and flow and stuff like that. So a lot of the professionals were pissed off because they weren't getting enough people buying their stuff, which is fair. Or not a whole lot of exposure either. But at the same time, it made it very intimate and small. And so it made them have FaceTime, like professionals have FaceTime with me. So for me, it was a great outing. Mm-hmm. I got to talk to him and got to talk to Brian Keene and Jack Ketchum, another big horror writer, quite a bit. And Linda Addison, who's I'm kind of name dropping. I talked to her briefly, but she's a very, very nice lady. She does horror poetry.
Oh, my God. That's a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing.
I mean, of course it has to be, but it's that just sounds like a Portlandia sketch.
No. I think she's from back east originally, and now she lives in Tucson, Arizona, which is, you know, the right. Southwest version of Portland.
I just mean that it's so specific and so niche.
You're talking about horror the most.
It's already niche.
Well, it's niche because people have this huge bias against it, even though they watch other versions of it that isn't called horror, but they're okay with that. Now, no, it was a really fun event. I also got to talk with some other authors and kind of, I got to hang out with like Rachel Autumn Deering and Steve Kozinek, who are kind of up and comers in their various fields, and they were really cool and nice to hang out with. So
you are name dropping.
I am name dropping.
I am swimming in these names.
I got to have fun.
Well, no, it sounds cool, but back to the podcast thing. Was it a live recording? Like, was it in front of an audience, and he was just like, "Come up here!" Ah! And
then he did it in his room. He had it was like a round table. There were three other young up and comer, like newbies, like me. Mm-hmm. And he asked us various questions, and we went around. I plugged the podcast. Don't worry.
I know.
I mean, I made a gibbering ass of myself, so nobody will listen. But yes, I plugged
it. If you want more of this, where do we find you? Yeah, right. Well, no, that's cool. You just kind of told me randomly on Facebook IM, and then I was like, what? And so I looked it up. I looked it up to see what this podcast was or who this Brian Keene was, because I'm not as well-versed in modern horror authorship. I was like, this is like a real podcast. He's like a real guy.
Yeah. He's
what
he's,
the hell happened?
Yeah, just dumb luck. Like I said, everything good in my life happens because of dumb luck. Anytime I try to force things, it fails miserably. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. It sounds like you had fun.
Oh, I did. It was a blast. Again, like bad for the professionals, but good for like the newbies who got to like force themselves on professionals and be like, hi, I'm a person. I exist.
Right. Today, we're going to be talking about Captain America Civil War. And at the end of the show, we're going to review the Russian vampire film Night Watch of the Night Watch, Day Watch saga, if you will. I didn't do a whole lot. I've been working a ton. I requested a Saturday and Sunday off. Saturday for free comic book day.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunday because our friends, Kate and Ashley, were in town and I wanted to visit them. And they kind of wanted me to be their free tour guide of Los Angeles.
I would assume they wanted to hang out with you, too.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been part of it. No, JK, Ashley actually listens to the show now, so I can't, like, be mean. No, it was fun. And on the free comic book day, we went to North Hollywood, and there was a restaurant bar down there called The Federal, where Blast Off Comics was having their free comic book day events in their parking lot. Like, they basically just, like, filled it out with booths. And a bunch of people showed up, and we showed up kind of late because my friends did their thing in Orange County first, so we kind of rendezvoused there around 2:30, and the event went till 4 o'clock. Steve Niles was there, but I think we missed him because I never saw him at the booth.
Mm.
But I really wanted to talk to him because I was going to geek out about how he was in a bunch of cool DC punk rock bands back in the 80s. because I doubt that many people talked to him about that. But then,
I bet he gets a weirdo like you every once in a while.
Yeah, I'm sure every once in a while somebody brings him a Gray Matter 7-inch that they want him to sign. But then we started seeing a little smaller line kind of trickling out. Now, this event was not that big. It was like maybe 6 or 7 good-sized booths, and then like in the middle, Loot Crate was giving away free comics. But we started seeing a small line starting to form. I was like, why is there a line? And then somebody close to us was like, oh, Nathan Fillion and Alan Tudyk are going to show up and sign something. And I was like, what? So we all like quickly get in line. And they had some comic out that they were giving away for free comic book day that I guess they're in or have some involvement in. And they were signing that and, shaking their hands.
Does that have to do with their web series, Con Men?
Maybe. You know, I didn't actually look at the comic. Because before I went out there, when they were doing Orange County, I was in Santa Monica at Heidi Ho. And I grabbed a bunch of stuff, and I haven't looked at that either. I guess there's one guy there, an artist or a representative of this new comic company. Maybe you know something about this. That's owned by Michael Bay. Like, he's involved with it, and he has this big line of comics out now. It looks like he's very much going from the model of Image, where it's creator-owned stuff.
Sure.
It's all a bunch of kind of like crime ish, like crime horror thriller comics. And they're all kind of written by these like TV people. Like one of them that I grabbed is written by, some writer from The Wire.
Okay.
And then there was a few other titles, and he's like, this guy from this TV show, he started this, and this guy from this TV show started this. I'm like, this is really strange. Like, all these people are like, we got to get into the comic book game, because that's where it's at.
Well, I think it's a cheap way to start branding something. So if it makes, I mean, that's how you sell anymore. Mm-hmm. Is if something has a brand, then you can latch it on and be like, you can have a minor audience and then try to grow it from there.
Right.
So I don't know. It makes sense to me. I think I mildly heard about some Michael Bay comic thing a while ago, but I didn't pay attention.
I doubt that he has like that much creative input. I'm sure it's just like a company, like one of many companies he owns.
Well, it might be an arm too, because I mean, they might eventually try to, I know Legendary had a line for a while there too. They might still, but it might be to try to get properties as well, to acquire certain comic rights and stuff like that. So, I mean, if he could acquire, which I doubt that would happen, but if he could acquire like Transformers and and the other various things that his studio owns to make films of, then it could be a cross tier, whatever platform, blah blah conglomerate.
Right. I mean, that definitely could be the case, but I think those are pretty hot properties to get, especially Ninja Turtles. I mean, I think Transformers changes companies about every 5 minutes.
Mm.
But Ninja Turtles, IDW has that right now, right?
Yeah, it's been at Image, it's been at a few different companies, but...
Right, right.
But it was, I mean, but I think Eastman, Kevin Eastman has, and his other partner, I forgot his name right now, has always owned some part of it, so... Because Ninja Turtles, the first Ninja Turtles movie, he produced that technically, and it was like one of the biggest independent films for a while, so...
Right. I just realized this is going to be one of our geekiest episodes. So if you're a comic book fan, whew, this one's for you. let's go ahead and get into the movie news. And we're going to do another lightning round because we want to talk about everything that's here, which doesn't always happen. But, you know, we were just talking, I guess it's that time of the year. But I'll start with this one. Justin Lin, the probably most famously known for doing the Fast and the Furious movies, or the better ones anyway, will be directing Space Jam 2 with LeBron James. So we talked about a while ago that LeBron James was being eyed to star in a Space Jam sequel. Do you have an opinion about this?
Do I need to have an opinion about this? It's going to happen.
Right. Your opinion changes nothing.
Yeah, it's Space Jam, so hopefully it does. I don't know. I love the Looney Tunes. I mean, if I'm being, especially those old cartoons.
Right. Which Space Jam has very little to do with.
Yeah. I mean, there's a weird nostalgia thing attached to it, but other than that, I don't have a whole lot I can say about Space Jam becoming an entity again. I hope it does a favor for the Looney Tunes, and maybe they make a few new cartoons. That's all, and good ones.
Right.
That's all I can really say.
I'll say this before we move on. LeBron James was actually pretty good in Trainwreck, the Amy Schumer comedy. He plays himself in it, and he was actually, you know, charismatic enough for a non-actor.
That's a leg up on Michael Jordan. But
I would say probably about that good, maybe a little better. and that I still say that Space Jam, the first movie from whatever it was, 1995, 1996, is one of the weirdest movies ever made. Like, if you actually break it down, the plot elements of why these characters are meeting each other, how they end up in the same place, how Bill Murray somehow gets roped in, like, on paper... Without any context, it is one of the weirdest fucking movies that has ever been greenlit and, like, released by a mainstream studio.
And they make that one guy into a basketball.
Yeah. Knight, whatever his
Wayne
name
Knight?
Wayne Knight, yeah.
Yeah.
Lightning round.
Moving on. So that series that I really like, Puppet Master, they're going to reboot it. The director, S. Craig Zahler, who was kind of known for a kind of a cult smash Western hit, Bone Tomahawk. I'm glad that they're getting somebody. The fact that they're rebooting it is kind of crazy to me. I mean, I guess there is a comic out there and it has a small cult following, but
yeah.
Of any of the series, I am pretty, of all the horrible series that I revisit it and rewatch at times, this one I'm actually pretty excited for. So,
right.
Yeah. And there's a lot of I kind of hope they kind of bring out the old puppets and do quite a bit of it the old fashioned way, or even try to do the like stop motion a little bit.
Yeah. Not just CGI it.
Yeah. But at the same time, with those kind of tools like CG, they could do some interesting things that they haven't been able to do. And in the later series of the Puppet Master, when you start to get to the end, they have to get real lazy. They're not doing stop motion. They're just got a person under there and they're not even like a hand up in the puppet. They're just like, they've just got the camera so high and they're walking it across the screen with their hand. And you can just, its little head is bobbing.
Like you can tell that they're basically playing with the puppets like they're Barbies.
Yes, exactly.
Well, okay, so maybe this takes a little bit of context. For people who don't know, the Puppet Master movies were these really, really cheap horror movies that I guess they're kind of, it was sort of adjacent to the haunted doll kind of craze that happened after Chucky, but it's a lot more mythological. There's kind of like a mythology to this entire thing. And then towards the middle of the series that went for like a really long time, because I think it went direct to video by part three, and then there was like seven or eight more.
There's 10 or 11, I believe.
Yeah. And then the puppets weren't even like bad guys anymore. They weren't killing people. It started to become like, they were like almost like heroes. Am I right-ish?
Well, they were kind of, I mean, they were just instruments the whole time. And I mean, yeah, you're right about the mythos, because they reach back into World War II and ancient Egypt. And I mean, it has a strange...
It gets weirdly dense.
It does. But I mean, that's the wonderful thing about
Puppet Master. For B-movies.
Yeah. If you do like B-movies, I do. I recommend it. I recommend it just because they're fun. Also, I forgot what the name of the you know his name, the director that's done a few of them.
Oh, David DeCoto. Yeah, he did part three, and I think he did maybe a couple after. And David DeCoto,
7, 8.
David DeCoto is a schlock master. He's been making terrible movies for a very, very long time.
But they're sort of good for terrible movies. That's right. That's my point about it. Is like you're watching it and you're like, this is. I mean, it's sort of cheesy, but at the same time, I'm like, enjoying this, so he's doing something right.
We'll see.
Also he was the first time that I realized, like, oh yeah, I understand the male gaze slightly.
Right, because David DeCoto is famously a gay director who makes a lot of homoerotic films, not necessarily pornography, but just kind of like silly movies that happen to have shirtless guys in it. Anyway,
13 films, I think they are.
Yeah, I forgot what they're called. They're all over Netflix, all of those like Frank and Queen and whatever's going on there. And then he makes like kids movies like The Talking Cat. But the Bone Tomahawk guy is decidedly more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we always say, this is so not a lightning round right now. No. We always say that if they're going to remake something that could be made better. Don't remake Taxi Driver. Don't remake like, you know, Blade Runner. Remake something that was kind of shitty and could use an update. This is exactly the type of property that could benefit from a remake.
I still enjoy them. They are B-schlock, but to get a little bit more serious and really try to do something with it, that I can get behind. Lightning round, let's move on.
Right. Dear White People, the movie both of us really liked from a couple years ago, directed by Justin Simien, Chapman graduate. He finally got his movie picked up as a series by Netflix. I knew this was something he'd been trying to develop pretty much since Dear White People was released. And good for him. It's a good home for that kind of property, because it is, I don't want to say niche, because I don't think that's necessarily true. I think Dear White People has a larger appeal than the title might make it seem. Right. But the thing I think it'll benefit from being a television series is because it has a very rich cast. Hopefully they're all the original cast members are going to come back, or at least a good handful of them. And it's a great setting for a television series because it's a college campus. So you can do a lot of things. It's an ensemble, so you can move from character to character. It makes sense. The only thing that's going to be a little difficult, I think, is that if he wants to keep the themes there, the sort of thing about racial identity and fitting in and that kind of stuff, it would be a little difficult to do a show where those kind of themes are hit on every single episode without that becoming tiresome.
Right.
But I'm into it. I think he's an extremely talented writer, and I want to see what comes out of it.
Well, I think you have the Netflix boon.
Yes.
So that means you can get the actors back on more easily because you can work around schedules. You don't have to do the TV schedule,
right,
of the standard networks. But yeah, I think Netflix is great for that as well, because I think he can explore those and kind of come in and out of the idea of race pretty easily. Lightning round, moving on. Adam McKay to finally make a superhero movie with Irredeemable. Irredeemable is about like a supervillain who kind of like is trying to like redo himself. It's kind of in, I hate to use this term, but it's in a postmodern kind of superhero way where it's kind of almost, it's talking about the weird, silly parts of superhero universes and contextualize them and do them kind of in a different manner. I believe if I'm not mixing this with something else, like the actual character Irredeemable is like one of the most horrible villains. He goes to a separate dimension, and then when he comes back, he's seen things through a different light and is doing things differently.
Right. So it's about a supervillain that's trying to reform.
He was like one of the worst of the worst. And so when he comes back and he's trying to be a hero, it's not like everybody's like, okay, you're a good guy now. Let's join the Avengers. It doesn't work that way. He goes, oh, okay, we're still going to try to murder you. Even the heroes, the cops, everything like that. So it plays with it in a different light.
Right. Subversive.
It's slightly subversive. I think it's still superheroes at its core, but right. Adam McKay doing it could be very interesting. He hasn't ever taken on necessarily directly besides like rewriting Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be down to see that.
Everything you said sounds cool. I know very little about this character, but I do know that Adam McKay at one point was attached to Ant-Man and then kind of hopped off the project. And his latter work has been very interesting with The Big Short. Not to say that this is going to be anything like that, but I like that he's diversifying. I like that he's just not the Will Ferrell guy anymore, that he has kind of his own thing to say or do. And he's, you know, at this point in his career, really kind of doing as much as he can. So
well, I know he wants to make a global warming movie, too. So, yeah, no, I'm glad he is, too. I think he's also showing through The Big Short that, you know, a Will Ferrell comedy guy can be more than just a Will Ferrell comedy guy. Moving on, lightning round. Alden Ehrenreich, meet the new Han Solo.
Alden Ehrenreich.
Okay, thanks for doing that. What did I say? Alden?
I don't even know. Alden Ehrenreich, who played Hobie Doyle in the last Coen Brothers movie Hail Caesar, which I think was even though that movie didn't like burn up the box office, I think that was a little bit of a breakout role for him.
True.
Because it was a high profile movie that was being written about a lot, and a lot of people took him away as one of the best things about it, and rightfully so. Alden Ehrenreich is a very talented actor. I think I talked about him a little bit when we reviewed that movie, and when we heard that he might be up for the role of Han Solo, young Han Solo, even though I think some people have written that he's roughly about the same age that Harrison Ford was when he played Han Solo the first time.
So he's like 30.
Something like that. I don't know. He certainly is a little bit more baby-faced, though. In fact, a lot of people have compared him to a young DiCaprio. And that's that's evident in his work. I think he's great. I think he has a lot of charisma, and I want to see him do big things. And back when I saw him in the Francis Ford Coppola drama Tetro, which almost nobody saw, I said, this kid's going to go somewhere. And then I saw him a few years later in a terrible a Twilight knockoff called Beautiful Creatures, which was better than it should have been and better than any of the Twilight movies, largely because he was in it. And I said, hey, he's back. Good. Good for you, Alden Ehrenreich. So, yes, good for him.
From what I've seen him in, he seems like he'd be pretty great. So as Han Solo specifically, I think he has the look, he can do the charm, and he's a good enough actor to pull off the chops. So, yeah, I'm into it.
Cool. Last story. Gael Garcia Bernal is the new Zorro. That sure makes sense.
Oh, you mean because he's Latino?
Well,
no, I'm being serious.
Yeah, I mean that as well as the fact that there's very few younger-ish Latino actors that are still prominent or, you know, leading men especially. Because you could say, like, there's Michael Pena and there's a few other people. But he has the look. He has the look. He's the right age for it. He has enough of a pull to bring people in. And he also has growing room as an actor. He could lead a blockbuster and become bigger than he already is. And I think Zorro is a great vehicle to do that for him.
Do you know the name of the guy who was in with an E Tu Mama Tambien? It's Diego something.
Diego Luna?
Luna, that's it.
That's his name. That was with him in E Tu Mama Tambien, which...
Yeah.
Yeah, they were like children in that movie.
Well, I hope he's in this. I mean, he's going to... Okay, so I'm glad that he's finally getting work too, because I think he's just as good as Gael Garcia Bernal, and that's not damning with faint praise. They're both great actors.
Yeah.
He's also Diego Luna is going to be in one of the new Star Wars films, but this is going to be like he's going to be in that Rogue One one.
The one that I saw the trailer for that recently.
Yeah. It looks kind of fun. This is going to be the Jonas Karan steampunk futuristic Zorro. So, and the Jonas, who is Alfonso Cuarón's kid, who did the movie E Tu Mama Tambien. Anyways, there's a connection.
Yeah.
Just know that. There's a connection. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, that was lightning round.
Yeah, cool. Let's go ahead and get into our review for Captain America Civil War. Do you want to set it up? You saw it, more recently than I did.
Correct. This kind of brings back Captain America into trying to find Bucky, as well as kind of some of the fallout from the Avengers films and the various adventures they've taken. And it kind of brings it back to like, oh, look at all this stuff crashing around. And a very popular thing to do in superhero films right now. This actually comes from an actual comic, so it kind of makes sense what they're doing because it's already kind of played with that ground in Civil War. Civil War is literally about Captain America taking one position and Iron Man taking another position on this issue of whether the superhuman entities should be held responsible with the Sokovia Accords. This big almost Avengers event, not almost, I think it is an Avengers-esque kind of thing,
yeah,
is done by the Russo brothers again, who did Captain America Winter Soldier. What I have to say about it is they do these very intimate moments. They don't have to have the over-the-top ending. I think they do some things very right. However, I still felt like, I know this is going to be against the grain, but I think it's a little over bloated. There are two characters in specific. I think Ant-Man and Spider-Man could have been cut from this film easily, and it would have felt more intimate and more and just more
focused
on the general narrative. Now, all the other characters, that being said, like, everybody kind of got their spotlight time, and I didn't really feel like anybody was left out. But I could have seen more from Falcon. I could have seen more from War Machine. I could have seen more from the Vision and Wanda. I could have seen all from that. Ant-Man and Spider-Man seemed rather tagged on to me.
I completely agree with that.
This I don't think this is as good as Winter Soldier. I don't think this is as good as Guardians of the Galaxy and some of the just better Marvel films. However, I do think it's still a pretty good film. I was entertained. If we're saying Avengers movies where there's lots of characters, I think this is maybe the best of those.
I would also agree with that.
So in some terms, it's kind of a, one of their better films, but it's not necessarily one of their best films. I guess I would Ant-Man is like my exact middle ground.
Right.
The Marvel movie. So I would say it's better than that, but not as good as their best films, if that makes sense.
Right.
I do think it brought up some of the issues. And what I think is interesting about specifically how they use it is you can take it two ways. You can make it about profiling. That's the word I'm looking for. You can make it about profiling people because they're different.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can also say, or if you're looking at it from the Iron Man perspective, you can say, oh, this is sort of like, you know, people being able to own guns and guns rights. So I think it's a very dynamic and interesting way to kind of look at political ideas that are kind of happening now. And I think that's the best thing that superheroes do. So in exploring those themes a little and being entertaining to boot, I still think it's a pretty good movie.
Right. You know, this is going to sound kind of strange, but I think a lot of the things that the best things about this movie only highlight the worst things about this movie.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. Like, there's the Russo brothers, they have a really interesting take on this material that I think is very strong and I think is really, really what elevated Captain America Winter Soldier, which I would think is at least in the top two of the MCU movies. And one of the reasons that movie was so good is because, unlike all of these other Marvel films, or maybe some of the more middling ones, it's that are fun and fluffy and have their own personality to some extent, but for the most part, just kind of feel like a stepping stone to another movie or like some sort of connective tissue for the Marvel Universe to kind of operate. Their movies feel a little bit more substantial and a little bit more vital as far as the stories they're telling.
Well, one thing that I think they do well is that they, even though it's a film and it stands, I do think that their films stand on their own. They still look at it as an episodic thing. These right. characters have gone through things. You can't just go, okay, well, I want to take my own like path. You have to be like, oh no, these characters have real dilemmas and real things happening to them. So I think that's something that they do well.
Right. Yeah.
Bringing into their films.
They carry over.
Is a history.
They carry over. Even if like the films that they're referencing, those characters didn't seem to take a lot from it. They were just kind of getting through an adventure. They'll bring that. They'll imply a psychology that goes back to that.
They contextualize it really well. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the biggest differences between this Civil War and the comic book Civil War, which, I mean, they're really night and day different, is the inciting incident. Mm-hmm. In the original comic Civil War, which came out, I think, when we were like, I think we might have even been living together at that time.
I don't know. It was about 2008.
2008? I thought it was like 2005. I mean, it was a while ago. And it was a big deal in the comics at the time. But the inciting incident that I kind of like it, actually. I thought that was really clever, but I can see why they couldn't do it in a movie because this cinematic universe just isn't quite as expansive yet. But the inciting incident in the comic was that there was a bunch of superheroes or super people who were in a reality television show and they were grandstanding and ended up blowing up a school in the process to do something cool for the camera. Which really makes sense that after an incident like that, the government would step in and say, okay, you guys are way too over your head and you need to be checked. And it makes a lot more sense for Iron Man to take such a strong position. Whereas in this movie, the inciting incident, strangely enough, very similar to Batman v Superman, is they're held accountable for all the collateral damage they've caused in all the previous movies. All those big, epic Kevin Feige endings. They're being shown on a television screen saying, yeah, this... this event, you actually killed this many people. In this event, you actually killed this many people. And then, of course, Iron Man has this very Jaws-like moment where a mother of a dead son comes up to him and, you know, slaps him and tells him, "You killed my son!"
I think it still worked. Tony has been wrestling with his identity as Iron Man for the last, like, two or three films, so it's kind of...
Especially,
psychology worked to me there.
Right, and I think that Robert Downey Jr. is such an effortlessly good actor that there's a couple scenes in here where he's acting with a capital A. Like, he's acting much more than he maybe even needs to for these movies, and he's gets into it. And then a scene later, he's jokey again, and it's kind of like, okay.
I don't know. It works because the character for me. I mean, you've already built that into him. So I don't know. I can't completely agree with you, but for me, the biggest thing was a lot of these side characters I thought were highlighted in a fun way, including the Winter Soldier, who we haven't really got a real personality out of until this film.
Yeah.
And I think Sebastian Stan is a decent actor, and I think this gave him. I also liked watching Vision and Scarlet Witch in this film kind of interact and have a weird sort of like chemistry together.
Yeah, and they both got something to do. I think that Scarlet Witch was a little wasted in the last movie in Ultron, and I actually kind of came away from that being like, I don't know if I like this Scarlet Witch even at all. But in this, I can kind of see her as like being something.
Yeah. I also, this is just a nerd thing, but I really like seeing Vision suits. When he was at the Avengers, like, I was like, cool.
Yeah.
That's funny. That is Vision. I think it gives him texture that he doesn't always have to be in a suit. It gives him a texture so you can kind of be like, oh, he's a being, like, for the film as well. So there's a lot of things they do right. Again, I think it's just really the thing that kind of diminishes it is I think it's just overly bloated. No.
I agree with you. I actually have no problem with the inciting incident. I'm just outlining that they're different.
Oh, okay.
And that this movie is talking a lot more about wrestling with the fact that these movies, these superhero movies, have to meet a certain budget, and they have to have a certain amount of bombast for people to feel like they got their money's worth when they walked out. And because of that, nobody ever talks about the obvious collateral damage of what's going on to make these big blow them up scenes, and then
until Man of Steel.
I think
everybody was like, "Holy shit, you just destroyed millions of lives!"
Right, exactly. And you know, I think it's kind of funny that both movies that are about, you know, a duel of personalities have an inciting incident that's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and the first half of the movie plays out very similarly to Captain America: Winter Soldier, where it's almost more of a thriller. It's almost a little bit more of kind of a mystery or whodunit, or you know, there's a kind of intensity in the way that the scenes sort of build up, and you know, there's questions to be had, and there's, you know, a little bit of intrigue that kind of feels a little outside of, especially a team-up superhero genre.
Adding on to that, I could have done with a lot more Daniel Brühl.
Yes, he's very good in this. He plays...
one of the most menacing villains I think we've had, one.
Yes, two. And also the only thing that's ever seen cool coming out of Hydra.
I always liked Hydra, but I thought that, again, I thought that that belt on Winter Soldier making Hydra like a real, actual, somewhat scary entity. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that the little inciting incident, where they had Crossbones, the Frank Grillo character that kind of came back over in this film, I thought that was a little throwaway too.
That's a very minor complaint. Well, I see that they're trying to establish kind of the look and style of the movie. Also, it sort of mirrors the opening of Winter Soldier with the boat scene, where they want to show you kind of what the style is going to be. And Winter Soldier was actually a little bit, stylistically, was during the action scenes, was a little bit more pulled back. Mm-hmm. And they kind of let scenes kind of play out a little bit more. And this is a little bit more hyperkinetic, a lot more kind of shaky cam. And it reminded me a lot, especially in the hand-to-hand combat scenes, reminded me a lot of the Paul Greengrass Bourne movies.
Agreed. I still preferred Winter Soldier in that respect.
Yeah.
Not, but I you have to
that
do
was intentional. I think they said, I think they were trying to say, we're going to do a Bourne movie, but with superhero movie with superheroes in it. So I think,
yeah. And I think that they did get into a little bit more of like, I still feel like there were a lot more personal stakes in this one, whereas that one had more like action oriented stakes. And in that respect, I kind of give it a thumbs up over Winter Soldier, because I was like, oh, that's interesting. These characters are really feeling and having, they're like, oh, fathers, mothers, sons, daughters, all you're killing these things.
Right.
And so I found that interesting. But again, something that I thought interesting and which makes me more excited for the Avengers films to come is even what they know how to make gravitas in small instances.
Mm-hmm. Like,
so, I mean, even though Falcon or Black Widow or some of those characters aren't the titular or even that much in focus, every scene they have gives them something to do. And it gives them something to say and adds to their character in the larger context. So, again, this is one of this is a pretty decent Marvel film.
Yeah.
In the top fourth, I guess you would say. But, even the two characters that we're talking about, Ant-Man and Spider-Man, that I just feel like that they're the easiest to get rid of. I don't feel like they add a lot to the narrative.
Yeah.
That being said, they were kind of, I mean, in where they weren't done necessarily poorly. I'm excited to see Spider-Man when that comes out. I don't think it necessarily added to this film in the best way. Same with Ant-Man. I think Paul Rudd's still funny, and getting to see his other alter ego was kind of interesting as well, because I always thought that was hard to show in comics, but would have been, but is a great visual, like in film, because you can show the scale a lot better.
Yeah. I agree with you completely on those two characters. And I thought that, the scenes with Tom Holland as Spider-Man, which, you know, the only reason he's in this movie is because they just got the property and they want to show it off, are really good. And he, like, those, like, 15 minutes that he's in the movie completely took the bitter taste out of my mouth from those terrible Amazing Spider-Man movies.
I will still defend the first one.
You can do that all day long.
I will.
I was just like, yes, this is Spider-Man. This feels like Spider-Man. And he has no business being in this movie.
Agreed.
Like,
it kind of feels like, but I will say,
I enjoyed the hell out of those 15 minutes, but it is so much of a divergence into something else completely.
It felt very superhero kind of comic, like Marvel oriented team up kind of thing to me, though, because sometimes that just happens where a character will show up for like three or four pages and you're like, okay, I guess that didn't add anything, but sure.
I mean,
so in that way it made sense to me, but at the same time it didn't make it better.
Yeah. And I actually think that, you know, they'd already done the legwork with Ant-Man and, you know, did a whole movie with him, and he's, you know, messed around with Falcon. So I was surprised at how clumsily he was integrated.
Cool set pieces with him.
Yeah, no, totally.
Again, his alter ego, spoiler, Giant Man was in it. I'm glad that they didn't put that in the trailer. And also there was this weird thing where he was in Tony's suit. And it was like became a submarine movie for like 3.5 seconds.
Yeah.
some of those things were fun, but I mean, if we're talking about characters adding depth, it didn't really do much.
Well, you know, I mean, at some point these characters have to fight, right? Because that's what this is all leading up to.
Mm-hmm.
That was for me from that point on in the movie. All of the intrigue, all of the cool Russo brother kind of like Jason Bourne espionage-y, you know, stuff with Hydra and Daniel Brühl and this kind of serious movie they were making, serious as you can get with superheroes. I felt really kind of like fluttered away as soon as that big superhero fight happens, where it almost felt like professional wrestling, where, you know, like there's no actual stakes. They're not, no one's gonna kill somebody, because they are friends and we got to do more of these movies. So nobody's going to, like, you know, Black Widow's not going to, like, stab Falcon in the neck and be like, die, motherfucker. Like,
that would have really changed it.
Credits.
Then you wouldn't have, you'd be kind of, I think, taken aback, maybe in a bad way, maybe in a good way. I don't know.
You're like, so yeah, the last third of this movie is directed by Lars von Trier. So, you know, there's no real stake, and it feels like it's, even though that's supposed to be like the ultimate scene that everyone's, you know, paying their $7 to see. Mm. I felt like it was kind of airless and silly, and it given all of the stakes behind it and all these ideologies that are clashing, it just, yeah, to me, it looked like a big professional wrestling match, and it was kind of silly. And then the rest of the movie is just kind of felt a little light in comparison, and sort of easily resolved, like considering all of this stuff they'd build up to that point. And I felt like a lot of the story stuff that they had were setting up in the first half of the movie, which I, like I said, was, I think, some of the best stuff we've seen in the MCU, kind of just gets forgotten or thrown away or unresolved. So I am very divided on this movie, in that I think that it has neck to neck, like next to each other, some of the best scenes we've ever seen in these movies, right next to some of the dumbest ones we've seen.
I wouldn't go as far as that, but it does definitely kind of take you away from the rising action. But I fell right back into it once we see Daniel Brühl again. Again, there are some things in here. Again, I think Daniel Brühl, I think something we haven't talked about, which we should, because I think Chadwick Boseman, who plays T'Challa, Black Panther.
I completely forgot he was a part of this.
But that's the thing, is he was really damn good in this, and he had some real scenes to chew on. And even though you don't, he's just barely introduced, like you understand what he's, you get enough from him that you're like, oh, he's relevant.
Right. That's kind of what I'm talking about, is you have that's the movie. I kind of feel like this went through rewrites or something weird happened, because there's that element that's introduced pretty early on that feels like it's going to be a much more prominent thing that runs throughout. And then there's the element with Daniel Brühl. There's all this stuff, this thriller stuff that I think really super works. And then as soon as that big team up fight happens in the middle of the movie, it feels like the movie just goes on autopilot and forgets all of the story that they were building with those characters.
Well, I feel like, again, there was a certain tone to this film, and I feel like that kind of, I think it kind of actually, the tone separated for that like 10, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And for some people, including yourself, I think that it would be hard to kind of regain that. I fell back into it pretty easily because once they kind of separated and they're all kind of nursing their wounds.
Yeah.
I felt like they closed that gap well enough. Mm-hmm. But for the same thing, if I'm looking at it as an entire movie, I've got to say, no, I do have to feel like it's a little overbloated with those parts in it. I don't think that it's, and again, like, I had fun with it, but I didn't come out of this like as blown away as I did with Winter Soldier or Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
I didn't feel that way. I felt like, oh, this was a pretty good, but I did, again, I wrestled with a lot of the elements, cause I was like, this was done really, really well. And I think you did say it. Some of those scenes, mm-hmm, are done better than they have been in any of the Marvel movies.
Right.
If we're talking about individual scenes, some of the best stuff we've seen, period.
Yeah, I really like Don Cheadle in this.
Oh, yeah. No. That was another character. I brought him up once or twice, but he was one of my favorite characters in this film.
Period. Yeah, War Machine. Yeah. Yeah. And he's a character I've always liked in general, so I was glad that they gave him something to do in this. Now, I came up, my overall feeling with the movie is, yeah, definitely go see it, especially if you're already invested, and let's not kid ourselves, you are. Mm-hmm. You're going to go see this movie anyway, and probably have at least twice, but I think it's totally worthy. And if this had been the movie we got instead of Ultron, which, mm-hmm, I still think is one of the more problematic Marvel movies, this would have been a really good sequel to the first Avengers movie that we got. And this is an Avengers movie. I mean, they call it Captain America's Civil War, and I guess Captain America's kind of the center of consciousness, but it shifts around quite a bit.
Right. Well, I think it's a good... I do agree, and he was like the headlining... He was one of the headlining characters in the original comic, and so I kind of see what they're doing. But I would have... Yeah, I could definitely see another film with him versus Daniel Brühl, like, truthfully.
Well...
Like, a little bit more boiled down... Right.
Based upon how it ended, I think we are going to get that.
Well, I can only hope, because, again, I really liked him in this, and he was one of the most menacing characters, even though he had, like, 15 minutes of screen time.
Right. And there's been some articles written about how this structurally kind of follows a lot of the beats of Empire Strikes Back. And I can see that, and I think maybe that's intentional.
I mean, they've done that several times, though. That's not...
Right, but I mean, there's a lot more direct parallels here, including the shawarma at the end of the film, if you're going to sit for it. And I think, actually, the ones in this movie are, you should. They should have actually just been in the movie, but you definitely want to sit through the credits.
Well, I think we're definitely going into new ground, which is exciting in a lot of ways, because we're talking Doctor Strange, Black Panther, Captain Marvel. We're getting another Guardians movie.
Wonder Man, yeah.
Well, that's going to be in the Guardians movie. That's sort of exciting to me, as not just as a comic fan, but as a moviegoer, because I'm like, oh, I'm getting new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is going in a different direction even. And I'm, again, seeing this makes me a lot more hopeful for the future of Avenger films, because I'm like, oh, no, I think these two can really do it.
Mm-hmm.
And pull it off. Because I don't dislike the other Avenger film a whole lot, but I they're definitely some of the more problematic of the Marvel Universe. And so I don't know, going forward, I think that this is a good beat to start off like a full on phase three. I'm also excited. I mean, again, with the shawarma, I'm really excited to see where Black Panther goes.
Agreed. And he deserves his own movie, and I hope he gets one. Oh, he is. Ryan Coogler is going to direct it. That's right. And that's exciting in and of itself. And also, you know, it kind of goes without saying, but I'm excited for that Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, me too, obviously.
And I don't want it too muddied up with MCU, Infinity Gauntlet, need to tie in everything ever. Like, I just want it to be a nice, clean, and it deserves at this point to be a nice, clean Spider-Man movie.
I think it will. I think you are going to get drop-ins. I know you're going to get a drop-in from Robert Downey Jr. But I think that can be done. And I did see Cop Car, by the way. So if they chose that director, John Watts, I think it is. If they chose him for the reason I saw that movie and saw that, that's a very interesting choice. A very interesting choice. So I'm excited to see that in that regard as well.
Cool. Well, let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework. The last segment.
The Night Watch.
Right. This is a Russian vampire blockbuster directed by Timur Bekmambetov, who I guess most Americans probably know him from the movies Wanted and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which came out a few years ago. This came out in 2004 and was sort of his breakthrough film that sort of exposed him to people outside of Russia. And it's kind of an idiosyncratic film that begins with this weird prologue about how, you know, it's all just a bunch of Joseph Campbellian stuff about the light side and the dark side, and the fate of the world is held between these groups of people who watch over the planet, the Day Watchers and the Night Watchers. And the Night Watchers, I guess, are vampires with sort of vague abilities.
Well, they're technically, the Night Watch is from the light side.
Right.
Which is interesting, because as the film goes on... Anyways, go on, sorry.
Yes, absolutely. Our main character, his name Anton, we're supposed to believe that he's sort of our Campbellian antihero, where he is told or it is told to us by the prologue that there is a person, you know, who's going to hold the balance between the good and the dark. And depending on which side he chooses to be on, it's going to put into the fate of the world. And he's told by what I'm guessing is his mother that if he wants to terminate a pregnancy, she can do it through magic. And he decides to do that, but then is kind of intercepted by the Night Watch. Which ends up throwing his world into disarray, and then we jump 12 years into the future, and there's all of these characters that are kind of being placed on this, I want to say political, but I only mean that in the most broadest sense, chessboard between these two factions. The plot mechanics are kind of dense. There's a lot of board game rules in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like a lot of that stuff is very inconsequential, and there's a lot of scenes that just kind of happen with, sure, with, very little relation to anything else that's going on. It seems like every single scene is bringing in a new plot element or a new, rule or a new, thing to explain. But I never really think it follows it up all that much.
I don't think it's supposed to either. I think this is, to me, this film was Delicatessen meets like a Blade movie.
Yes, I thought of that, especially stylistically. You can tell that at this point in Bekmambetov's career, he was very inspired by Jean Genet.
Well, and again, coming from Russia or a country outside of the United States, they kind of bring up these rules. But it's not as stapled down as American like cinema, where this has to lead to this and this has to be this.
Things are played a lot more fast and loose here, and maybe a little too fast.
I really enjoyed it. This to me, again, the first two Blade movies are some of my favorite teenage, as when I was a teenager, were some of my favorite movies.
Sure,
I really love the Blade movies. This kind of does a different take on that. And I think even though it's introducing a lot of magic and things like that, for fans of this kind of a movie, I think it's a lot of fun and very interesting. Also because you're getting a lot of these things filled in and through visuals. I mean, it kind of does like the underworld thing, but doesn't take it as serious or, And I wasn't as...
it's not as rainy or leather.
Well, I didn't have to roll my eyes when the half... spoiler alert from Underworld 1. you didn't have to have this half vampire, half werewolf baloney thing happen at the end, because it just had to go there. Mm-hmm. I think this does... it goes very fast, but I think it fills in the gaps for you enough. I don't think that you need to know everything about the world, and I was okay with that. I got the basics because people know what vampires are. People know what. And the other thing that's interesting about this film is it is playing with those Campbellian ideas. But the thing that I got out of it was that just because you're said to be the good guys or the light side, does that really make you the good guys or the light side? Because a lot of times they question, are you doing the right thing?
Right.
Is this good? Is it bad? And so I think it kind of plays with that concept in a fun way. I find it kind of, it is idiosyncratic, but I thought that added to the charm of it. I didn't think it was a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the movie doesn't lack personality.
No.
You know,
no.
I don't think that it's a very good movie, but I do think that it certainly has a lot of charm and style, and maybe a lot of that style sort of dates now. Because this movie, like, I didn't know this is a thing I would ever say, but this movie is very 2004, including the nu metal kind of score that's running through it. I don't know. It's a Timur Bekmambetov movie, and I feel like he's like the Russian Zack Snyder in a lot of ways. Like, I think he's a lot more interested in how things look and where he puts his camera and what the costumes are than necessarily anything that's going on in the story. The stuff you talked about, you know, choosing how do you choose and da-da-da. And there's actually some kind of serious stuff here about, like, paternity, and I've read somewhere that this could be seen as, like, an abortion allegory or something like that. I wish I had been able to see any of that in here. To me, this was just, like, exposition the movie with just a ton of weird CGI shit that looks a little cheap.
I see, and I enjoyed it. I don't think it was, like, I don't feel like it was, it's not as obvious as you see in some blockbusters where they're like, we spent millions of dollars on this and it still looks horrible. I think that they kind of blended it in and it looked fine. It does date a little bit, but I'm okay with films dating because movies, I mean, it's okay. You're watching something that's fake.
Right.
Yeah. And I think people pay way too much attention to that. And I'm not talking about you particularly in this instant. I'm just talking in general.
I just meant in an unflattering way. Like it reminded me of the stylistics that were very popular post Matrix.
Agreed. That was the worst part of, if we're talking stylistics, like there was no reason to do a fast, slow burn. And when you're throwing bags back and forth to each other, that's when it got where I was like, oh, that's silly. But I knew where it was from. And I mean, we grew up through that. So I was like, okay, I see what's happening here.
Yeah.
However, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I'm not saying that it's like a good with a capital RART at all, but I think as a fun, fantasy horror, brain candy, I think it's kind of fun and poppy. I kind of enjoyed it.
I 100% understand why this movie has a cult following. Like this, to me, this is very much like the Underworld movies that also have like kind of a goth following, or like, what was that movie? Equilibrium. Like there's a lot of movies that were kind of made around this time, post Matrix that were,
I will say I liked it more than Underworld films for me.
Right. I mean, I would say the storytelling of at least the first Underworld is a little bit more streamlined. So maybe I appreciated that, but I would say it's at least about at that level. And there's a lot, but like I was saying, there's a lot of movies that kind of like nerd culture sort of attaches to before the comic book movie thing really took off. Mm-hmm. And you were kind of, you know, taking what you could get. So you would have like an extreme fan base for Dark City or an extreme fan base for The 13th Floor. And then they all just eventually found their Marvel movies and forgot about those movies. But
again, I felt like this had enough personality to kind of warrant. And also, if I think about his films that I've seen where he's come to America and made it through the studio, mm-hmm. I feel like he's a little stilted. I feel like they kind of are like, well, we see you're good with visuals, but right. we want you to do a very typical, not very good movie through our lenses.
Right.
And I feel like watching him being a little bit more, be able to do his thing, it's a little bit more engaging, a little bit more interesting. I thought when they would go into those weird, like, gloom, dark realm things, I thought those were really interesting and kind of fun to watch.
It was a cool effect. I don't know. I still don't understand what it is. I don't understand, like, it's weird how much this movie, like, stops to explain something, and then how much this movie, like, does something really weird and really esoteric without explaining it at all. And it deals with exposition in ways that I think for me make it hard to get into.
I do feel like the beginning and end were tacked on because
what for American audiences.
Well, yeah, it's in English and the rest of it's in Russian.
Right.
So I don't think you would have got that at all. So I think if you would have saw it without those, you might have liked this more.
It would have made it a little more impenetrable, but I
didn't think it was that impenetrable. They're giving you very basic, like, fantasy sort of like magic rules. It's like, oh, only not everybody can see the gloom realm or the dark stuff,
right?
Only a certain amount of the people can, but you're getting to see it through the POV characters' lenses. You're getting to see a lot of these things that nobody else is seeing. Like, I thought it was pretty easy to kind of interpret myself, but I didn't feel like it was that fast or that loose, but again, that's just, I think that just comes down to taste. I didn't think it was that impenetrable. I was like, oh, that's fun. Oh, that's fun. Like, you're just doing
right. Shit. I mean, okay. No, I understand. I was basically able to follow it. But it, I don't know. I just I couldn't really get into it. Like I felt like the movie was sort of so aggressive in it in its style and so all over the place and moving so quickly that I without ever like stopping for a beat to kind of I guess get into the characters or get into the world building or anything.
I thought well the world build that. The characters, I agree with the world building. No, the world building was the whole movie.
No, yeah, the movie was just world building. That's all the movie was, but it wasn't like not in any way that kind of informs the characters. So I don't know. I completely understand why there's a cult following for this movie, and it reminds me a lot of the movies that came out from that time. I think it's mostly dumb.
I think it's fun. I don't know. I'm definitely going to check out Daywatch. So I had enough fun with it to kind of go on with it. I think that there is enough personality, and I think that there's enough, while not American streamlined sort of like, this means this and this means that, I think that there's enough of a tangential kind of like, oh, you're figuring out the world by just watching it and kind of contextual clues and stuff like that, that I can get into this. And I understand why it has a cult following, and I would be able to appreciate it with fans of that cult following. So,
okay. You'll have to, if Daywatcher makes any more sense in this movie, you'll have to tell me.
I think the point of it is, again, is that the Campbellian character, like, even though these are the light characters, they're really not necessarily the good guys.
I got the overall thing that these characters are kind of stuck in the middle of this political garbledygook that isn't either good nor bad. It's just two factions that have been fighting for years and years and years.
And I think it would be interesting to see with Daywatch, because when you're getting, because it's kind of like a companion piece, and right. When you're seeing two sides like that, that one is supposed to be good and one sees it, the other is bad. When you see it from the point of view of another character from the other realm, it's always interesting to me because you're getting kind of a strange, like, oh, it's really just a perspective thing. So I don't know. I liked it.
Next week, I'm going to have you watch the documentary Paris is Burning.
Okay.
This is one of my favorite documentaries, and I've seen it multiple times, and I've seen it recently. So, I figure we might have something to talk about. It came out kind of a while ago, 1991. There's definitely a lot to talk about it. And I just recently recommended it on a voicemail I left for the Listening Party podcast with a song I recommended. So, got me thinking about it again.
Okay, sounds good. I will be glad to try it out.
All right, and that's our episode. If anybody has anything they want to say, if you have opinions about Captain America's Civil War, and I'm sure you do, as well as Night Watch if you happen to catch it, or any of the news items that we talked about in this episode, please email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com, and we will read it on air. We also have a Facebook page that you can find us at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can also find us on Twitter @jabberpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Windows Podcast Network, Zune, and Pocket Cast. You can read my reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I have some content up at the Seattle-based entertainment site, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And check out Brad's Lit Zine blog that he does, his entertainment site that he just started. Now they have their own .com, panelandframe.com, which redirects them back to the blog that they started a while ago. And be sure to listen to our friends out there who do podcasts as well, including Leland from Olympia, Washington at dampercast.com, Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, who just hit the 200 mark and are celebrating with a two-part 200 episode, and Patrick, who's been on the show, and we've been on his, at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. So we'll talk to you next. Ugh, man, my tongue is all over the place. We'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one, buddy.
Bye.